Because of technical difficulties, the first several minutes of Asha's talk are missing.
In the earliest days of our divine effort, even in the earliest incarnations of our spiritual awakening, we begin to set patterns that we will be able to use all the way till the end. I know when Swami was writing the commentary to the Bhagavad Gita, there's a whole section about how you dissolve through inner vision the last remnants of karma when you have completely withdrawn from society and are living isolated in some cave or cell, and the only thing that binds you is this ephemeral bit of causal karma. And I was reading that when Swami had written it, and I said, well, this won't apply to everyone. And he said, no, it won't, but it will be very useful to those to whom it does apply. But the other aspect about it was that it laid out in front of us sort of the methodology that as above, so below, we can begin to follow even now. Now, in the Bible, in the New Testament, which is very truncated, really, a great deal of it is Jesus going here and Jesus going there. And there's just a few sections, really, that have the heart of the teachings of Jesus. And certainly one of these is this remarkable sequence where Jesus, returning from his disappeared time, in the Bible it's just a disappeared time. He was a young boy in his father's shop, and then he reappears and he starts his mission. It's becoming commonly understood that those, quote, lost years of Jesus, he went to the Himalayas and studied with the great yogis there, and that the tradition of Jesus is really a continuation of the Himalayan yogis. It's also being more and more commonly accepted that that section was simply removed from the Bible because as people's understanding became less and less, there was this greater and greater elevation of Jesus completely outside of human experience. And the dispute, as it is reported now, was that they didn't want to think that Jesus went to study with any masters because he was fully God's son from the start. Of course, that takes Christianity completely out of any context, greater context of religion, of Sanatan Dharma, of the tradition of masters and gurus, and how we learn. But that's a whole other discussion. But in this context, Jesus reappears as a full-grown man, and he's about to start his mission. And the first thing that happens is he goes to the River Jordan, and he's there where John is baptizing. And he comes to John to be baptized. And Yogananda explains that there was a deep karmic relationship between John the Baptist and Jesus, that John had been Jesus' teacher in the past, and baptism from him was still the appropriate action, even though Jesus' consciousness had gone beyond the need for that baptism. Nonetheless, out of respect for that relationship, it was appropriate. John, recognizing the truth of who Jesus is, says, I'm not worthy to tie your shoe, what to speak of baptizing. And Jesus said, it's in the fitness of things that this should be done. And so John baptizes him, and then the voice from the heavens is heard by all. And there's this great declaration, this is my son, in whom I am well pleased. You know, all who would find the truth, as Swami writes it poetically, walk where he leads. But then afterwards, before Jesus actually starts his mission, he goes off 40 days in the wilderness. And he lives, he doesn't eat, he doesn't relate to any other human beings. He just goes very deep into his own inner consciousness in preparation for the 3 years of ministry and the death that he knows he's going to have to face. And when he comes out of this, he is tempted by the devil, is how it's described in the scriptures. And some people dispute, you know, is there such a thing as a devil? Is there not? But all great spiritual aspirants sooner or later encounter either personified in front of them in some kind of a figure that certainly represents the devil, or at least one feels that there is some external force that is literally attacking the equanimity of our consciousness. And as Swamiji writes, whether you can explain that as our own subconscious tendencies or whether it's an external force, the experience is really the same. Haven't we all had that? We're just all set in a certain direction, even in the simplest way. And it really is like something just makes us be devilish, makes us say things we didn't want to say, takes away our resolution, and we really do feel like there's two forces at work, the way Master also explains it, which is a very powerful explanation, is on one side, we have our superconscious, which is the aspect of our nature which merges into the infinite. It's the doorway through which we escape ego consciousness and become infinitely free. On the other side, we have all these incarnations of identification with the physical body, identification with the ego, all these many lifetimes we've lived, and all the pleasures and pains and hopes and disappointments that are associated with that. We can just stand. We don't have to remember past lives to feel that. We can feel it just in the life that we live right now. Recently, I was one of our friends, David Gamow, his mother, at the age of 93, passed away. She passed away beautifully, courageously, she just refused to eat and drink anymore. She was too weak to do the things that she wanted to do, and she just willed herself out of her body, not in a sense of suicide, but in a sense of, well, the incarnation is over, let's just let it go. And David and I were talking about the joy he felt in his mother's courage and her willingness to go. And so it was impossible to really mourn, to really say, oh, I wish my mother hadn't died. She had lost the use of her body and she was losing her senses. How could you be so selfish as to want her to stay in that body? And of course you add to this the divine understanding we have of reincarnation and the eternal nature of the soul, and you see her liberated from that aged body and going off into the astral world. I've told all of you, many of you before, when I sat with my father when he breathed his last, and he too was in his 80s, and his body just gave up on him, that I felt so much joy when he breathed his last that it was impossible for me to even think on any level of sorrow. I had to mask my elation because, as my sister said, I was being rude to the mourning people in the facility where he lived who missed him, and I was just laughing about his departure, and I seemed a little mad to them, so I covered my face a bit. But nonetheless, and this is what David and I were speaking of, and I've certainly experienced it with my parents too, there's times when your eyes just fill with tears, and there's this extraordinarily poignant sense of something that used to be that is no more. And your philosophy is just worth nothing at that time. I drove down El Camino here, and I saw the Sunrise facility for elder people, and my father used to live in the Sunrise facility, and I didn't cry when he died, but I'm driving down the street and I see the Sunrise place and I think, oh, I shall visit my father no more. You know, in my eyes, I really begin to weep. And I think, where does this come from? You know, what is the meaning of this? And there's just this incredible poignancy to human life, isn't it so? We strive so hard. It's all so important to us. We give ourselves so completely, and sometimes we're fulfilled, and sometimes we're disappointed, and all of this just roils around inside of us. And don't kid, we mustn't kid ourselves. No matter how powerful our philosophy, it's not easy just to stand aside from all of that. And the masters give us a very interesting example, which is they don't really try. They live all of these dimensions of reality simultaneously. Master often, Paramahansa Yogananda, fully realized master, he would often weep. He would just be so moved, either by something sweet that was happening in life in front of him, or by someone's ignorance that he knew would cause them great sorrow. Or even when Sister Gyanamata, his most advanced woman disciple, died, and he declared that he'd seen her merge into the infinite light, never to return. Her own last words were, joy, joy, too much joy. And yet, when he spoke at her funeral service, he wept. Because that beautiful interaction, that divine play of Sister Gyanamata and Paramahansa Yogananda, he could see it all coming to a close. So we stand here with all of that pulling us and all that deep longing and all that hope that somehow it can all just work out And we'll never really have to give up anything. You know, that we can just, the wonderful phrase people use these days, we can have it all. The ego can be fully satisfied and the soul can be fully satisfied. But every divine epic, every great epic, is always about war. And feminist assertion, rebellion says that's because they were written by men. But it's not true. They're written, yes, it's true, from the masculine consciousness of the need to put aside all temporary feelings and put our eyes on the goal without reservation. Swami Kriyananda once in a wedding ceremony was just talking about the male and the female, not, you know, generally exemplified by men and women, but the reason that they're men and women is because before there was even creation, there was the duality of masculine and feminine. Yin and yang is the lovely neutral way the Chinese put it. But Swami just talked about the sun and the moon, which in our world symbolize the male and the female. The sun is usually described as male and the moon is always described as female. All the traditions, cultural traditions, it's very valid because the sun represents that powerful, illuminating, impersonal consciousness of male energy. And it rises and it sets and it changes, but it changes very slowly. Over the course of a whole year of our earth life, the sun will gradually shift the way it relates to the world. And this is the male consciousness, usually in men, but not always. Just this male consciousness. It has one reality and it follows that reality and it doesn't pay a lot of attention to all the ups and downs of things. Women sometimes complain intensely about that fact, but I've had so many women come to me complaining about their partners, and really all they're complaining about when you really get down to it is that they're married to a man and not to a woman. Because there's just that little tiny bit of difference. And to the woman, it seems like if he would just give up that tiny bit of difference and become, well, just like me, you know, then everything would work so much better. But men, I have learned, absolutely fold their arms and refuse to become women for the most part because they don't want to be women. They might not even, if you can believe this, women, find it attractive, you know, because women are like the moon, waxing and waning and waxing and waning and waxing and waning, and every time you look at the moon, it's doing something else, you know, and then it's finally got full, and then it conceives of this little idea that it would be better to change again, wouldn't it, because some little nuance has crossed its consciousness. And of course, this is the great strength of women, this of the female side. It's very sensitive. It's very adaptable. It tends to be intuitive. And if the male lacks that energy, the male is out of balance. And if the female is too committed to that constant shifting, it's crazy making. You know, it needs the balance of the masculine in all of this. Now, let me try to remember why I went there. Jesus coming. Oh yes, caught between these two realities. That's where we were. You know, so there is all this desire to just have have all this. I mean, the ego is so persuasive that happiness will be ours with just the tiniest shift. This is what Master said. This is Satan's most subtle weapon, is this constant hope that we're so close, you know, this lifetime almost worked out. It was just almost okay. And if we just made just the tiniest adjustment, then it would all just be fine. So we reincarnate again, and it's almost the same as it was, but we've just shifted it just a little bit. But then, of course, that opens us up to a new cliff. And this process of spiritual growth is really a very, very simple one, which is we try and we try and we try and we try with the power of our self-enclosed ego to just make our lives work. And what it means for a life to work is that it fulfills our heart. The heart has this instinctive longing, doesn't it? It believes that it was here, was brought into consciousness to experience happiness. And one of the reasons we suffer so much is there's this sense of wrongness to it. This isn't supposed to happen. I'm not supposed to be poor. I'm not supposed to be alone. I'm not supposed to be sick. I'm not supposed to be whatever has happened to us that we don't happen to like. because it's divinely implanted within us, is this knowingness that bliss is our true nature. And anything that happens that takes that bliss away from us feels fundamentally wrong. And we'll cover that wrongness. If we have low energy, we cover it by trying to put ourselves into a stupor one way or another. We drink, we watch television, we overeat, we're way too busy, whatever it might be, just something so we don't have to think about it. We're very rajasic, as they use the words from our reading today. We're just very, very active, or we use our activity to put ourselves into a stupor. But we try to cover the pain of that lack of bliss. Or we try to make it work. We're not yet willing to give up this self-will that says, I can do this all by myself. And the humility and the challenge required when we recognize that we have to shift our entire sense of identification. But over many, 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 many incarnations, we finally practice and try out enough different options. And Master makes the very, very chilling comment that everything that you're no longer attracted to, that you recognize as no longer going to be happiness producing for you, because you have tried it, you have drunk that cup to the bottom, and you have understood its limitations. Swamiji said, and it's very important to understand this, he said, we learn much more from our fulfillments than our disappointments. When we're disappointed and don't get what we want, we can always imagine that if only I'd gotten it, it would have fulfilled me. So it's not merely that we have to be disappointed. We actually have to succeed over and over again, because we have to know from our own experience. Isn't that so? It's just pointless to try to tell somebody a reality they haven't perceived. This is the kind of ignorance that in the Bhagavad Gita is described as the child in the womb, the embryo in the womb. No amount of effort will get that embryo out any sooner. It's just going to have to wait until it comes to a stage of development. And so it is with us. We or others around us, if we don't really from our own experience understand the truth of this, no amount of philosophy is going to make any difference. It's what I found so interesting about what I could think I knew about my father's death. And then what would just well up out of me, just completely without any will or understanding on my part. There's so much of our lives that we just have to patiently wait until the understanding is really there. And it serves us nothing to impose upon ourselves. In the Gita, Krishna puts it this way. He said it just doesn't serve anything to try to suppress the ego, to just say, I don't want it, I don't like it, I'm going to push it aside by my will. It's a very subtle line, because it doesn't really serve us just to indulge it either. But what we have to do is we have to remain constantly alert and observant and above all deeply self-honest to really understand, oh, isn't that interesting? Look at who I am. When I perceived in myself the ability to have this poignant sense of sadness about an event I was also delighted about, which was my father's passing, what it does is it just creates within us a deeper sense of humble receptivity, a deeper willingness to try to perceive reality rather than to declare it. This is the great pit that we fall into. We begin to try to declare what's true, declare what I feel, declare what should be, instead of just humbly receiving. This is one of the deep truths in the New Testament that we repeat in our festival. To all who received him, to them gave he the power. And that word receive, receptive, this is where the feminine, the masculine must be balanced by the feminine. In fact, there's a divine tradition that we are all female before the divine, that the only true male principle, which is the only real unchanging principle, is the divine, and all of us must be female in front of that. There's a story of there's a tradition in India of Naga sadhus. Naga means the sky. And Naga sadhus are sky clad, which is an elegant way of saying they don't wear anything at all. They're stark naked people. And they just live and they never wear clothes because they're just repudiating the body to such an extent. And for the most part, Naga sadhus live away from populated areas because it's a little disturbing. Although I was riding in a car down the streets of New Delhi, and there was a Nagasadhu just strolling down the road. He had a little bit of an orange cloth thrown over his shoulder, and he had nothing else on, and his disciples were just strolling along next to him, only in India. You know, everyone was just taking it for what it was. It's who he was. And there was this story about this woman. It's mostly such individuals are male, but there was a woman like that. And she never wore any clothes. And some of the villagers around were scandalized. "You should put clothes on," they said. "It's not seemly for a woman to go about like this." She said, "Why? I don't see any men around." Meaning that those who haven't achieved their full divine potential don't deserve the name of man. But then a saint was coming to her village, and she scurried around to find a sari to put on, because she said finally a man was coming to visit, and she, before him she wanted to be humble. Now, it's a beautiful story, not a literal one, I hope, that any of us are going to get involved in this country. You would simply be arrested. It really wouldn't be. It would be a very, very short sadhana, because you would be in jail. If you did genuinely feel inspired, you may try it, but I don't recommend it. You know? But if you genuinely feel inspired, you're probably not sitting here. You're probably out in one of those caves somewhere. But the point being that we have to... what is the point? The point is that there comes this point in our spiritual life where we really recognize that what we've been trying all these incarnations just really isn't going to work anymore. And we start... In the Festival of Light, we call it that. We call it this stage is the quest. Every time we say that, first the bird decides, well, I can do this myself. God sent me out here to work in cooperation with him, but I can do this myself. I mean, why not? Doesn't it seem like a smart idea to you? And we even have the bird say, what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? Why should I be so generous? Why should I always be thinking of others? Doesn't it just make sense to take care of me? I mean, isn't it the responsible thing to do? Wouldn't it be irresponsible to rely on God? God wants me to help myself. God helps those who help themselves. Isn't it true? I mean, there's all these wonderful rationalizations that we have for just sort of holding on to this poignant sense of, I just want it to be this way. And we must have a lot of respect for that delusion. It doesn't serve us to look at these powerful delusions that we've built up over many incarnations and just say, oh, I don't feel that way anymore. This was what was so remarkable about my tears over my father. Oh my God, you know, we just can't just push it like this. We have to have great respect for this world that God has created. And with that same respectfulness, that's what makes us devotees, not merely truth seekers. We seek truth, but then eventually to be a true truth seeker, you have to become a devotee. We have to have this deep reverence for this world God has created. And I don't mean for the creation, but for the way God has made us. And this deep inner relationship with that infinite power, however we can understand it. And what our whole reading here is about is also we must be deeply sincere about the reality of where we stand with that. God loves us. Well, the truth is you can't fool him anyway. You can't even fool your best friends, can you? You put on some big facade of how you really feel, and all you prevent them from doing is relating to you. You know, you never really fool them. Really think about it. I there was a point, and of course I live in a very tight-knit community, but at the very beginning I had to go through some very difficult personal times, and I had this inclination to feel embarrassed. I mean, naturally one does. And I just realized either one just accepts that we are what we are and the world is going to see us, or we spend our whole lives in the state of fear. And this state of fear is always reflective of our inner unwillingness. And what Master says is, you don't have to tell everyone your faults, because not everyone is mature enough to accept them, accept the responsibility of knowing them. He said, but before God, you must have no secrets. Before Divine Mother, we just simply have to be who we are. And even if that confession is, Divine Mother, I know I ought to give this up, but you know what? I don't want to. You know? I know the philosophy says I should feel this way, but I don't. So there we are. You know? I've heard my friends pray, and I love this prayer. Divine Mother, you either have to free me of this desire or you have to fulfill it. And that's very fair. And above all, that's what Divine Mother likes from us. What a master says is God doesn't mind our faults. We get very, very upset about our faults. God doesn't mind our faults at all. After all, he made us this way. What he minds is our indifference and our indifference to higher realities. Just be who we are, weaknesses, truths, whatever they might be. Just quietly within ourselves. Divine Mother, this is me. You made me this way. It's your problem now. It's such a sweet way to think about it. Yes, sir, it's true that I do behave this way, but we're doing our best. A dear friend of mine, once this all close with this story, she was given an assignment that she really couldn't do, and it just worried her and upset her, and it was a job. And finally, she sat down in meditation, and she said to her guru, she said, Master, you want this job done well? You find somebody else. You want it done the way I do it, which is not very good, you leave me in this assignment. And then after that, she said she never worried about it again. Isn't that dear? You want it done differently, Lord? Then you have to change my consciousness, because this is all I can bring to it, is who I am. You see how sweet that becomes? And really, ultimately, that's all we're trying to have. If it doesn't matter what happens in this life, if through it we become sweeter within ourselves and sweeter with God, and then the end, everything disappears anyway. You know, David's mother is gone. My father is gone. Pretty soon all of us will be gone. At Ananda Village last week, I referred to 40 years from now, you'll be telling stories about the dead founders of Ananda. You know, because of course, you know, people like myself will be the dead founders at that point and just gone. But the sweetness of our relationship with God, everything else dissolves. But that's eternal. Sister Gyanamata, into the light. Joy, joy, too much joy.